That's Eddie Harris, the man who electrified the saxophone with Listen Here. That's from his 1967 album, The Electrifying Eddie Harris. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It is Wednesday, January the 21st, 2015. And the sleeper issue of diversity in Hollywood is playing big this year. All 20 actors and actresses nominated in four main Oscar categories, lead actor, lead actress, supporting actor, and supporting actress, are white. And it has ignited a firestorm of protest, especially from African Americans in the industry. Selma, the biopic about Dr. Martin Luther King's leadership of protests in Alabama, particularly the Selma to Montgomery March that led to the passage of the Voting Rights Act, was nominated for Best Picture and Best Song. But director Ava DuVernay and the film's main actors were snubbed in their respective categories. Our guest is someone I know quite well and of whom I think very highly. He's Armand White, a film critic for the National Review and for Out Magazine, and author of three books on contemporary pop culture. And he's here with us to discuss The Big Scream about the big screen. Nice to have you with us, Armand.
happy to talk to you, Eutrice.
Well, let's start there. What do you make of the great hubbub about the fact that Selma, this movie, apparently, according to a growing segment of the populace and particularly within the industry, finds that this is a case of racism?
Oh, you know, I'm not buying it. But let me tell you why by starting out with a phrase is being used whenever this issue is discussed in the media. There's a familiar word that most discussions begin with, and that word is snub. I wish anybody who wants to talk about this issue would just take the word snub out of their Oscar vocabulary. For a very simple reason, there are about 500 movies released every year. There are only so many Academy Awards to go around every year. Everybody's not going to get nominated. Just because you don't get a nomination doesn't mean you have been snubbed. How about this? Snub, I think, is a kind of a mongrel term that's been inserted into the culture by the lowest forms of journalists. That would be gossip columnists. Gossip columnists talk about Oscar snubs because it makes it seem that the trivia they're discussing, and it seems when you discuss the Academy Awards, you are talking about trivia. The word snub makes the trivia of the Oscars seem somehow personal and maybe important, but it's the wrong term. Nobody gets snubbed. You know, Sally Field told the world back in the 80s, you get an Oscar because they like you. And it's a private group. If they don't like you, they don't like you. If they like you, they give you as many awards as they can. So I don't buy that Selma was snubbed. I don't buy that any other black actors were snubbed. They just weren't liked well enough by the Academy.
Well, you have some experience here because you were one of the jurors of the Academy. How does that work? How do people get liked?
Let me correct you. Actually, I was not a member of the Academy. I was on the jury at the Sundance Film Festival in
Sundance,
the year the Chameleon Street won. I've never been a member of the Academy. Although, like a lot of Americans who are interested in movies, I've followed the things that go on at the Academy for years. So I think I know a lot about it, and that also means I'm not fooled by what happens at the Academy. It's a private organization. It's a private institution. And in recent years, the institution really has opened up. There are more people of color in that institution than ever. For the past couple of years, including now, it even has a black woman president. If you want to accuse the Academy of racism, this is not the kind of racism that they exhibit. They don't exhibit anti-black racism at all or ever. If racism is evident in what the Academy does, it strikes me as being a strange kind of liberal racism, wherein they bend over backwards to give awards to and nominations to black people who don't necessarily deserve it as artists, but they get the nominations and awards just for being blacks. A kind of reverse white liberal racism or liberal racism. See how confused the issue gets with a word like snubbed. It isn't helpful. But what I dislike also about this so-called Selma controversy is that last year there were several very, very good films by black filmmakers, and so happens by black female filmmakers, that nobody's talking about. Films like Belle by Ama Asante, films like Beyond the Lights by Gina Prince Bythewood. Nobody's talking about those films because those films don't have big advertising budgets, which Selma has an enormous advertising budget. And all the controversy about Selma comes from the fact that its publicists are working overtime. And by working overtime, I mean the publicists are able to manipulate media folks into talking about a snub. They're able to manipulate the media into pretending that the mainstream media cares about racism. And so they bring up this really false idea that Ava DuVernay, a hardworking woman but a mediocre filmmaker, deserved an Oscar nomination. Kind of crazy, but then racism is crazy.
Wow. So let's pick apart some of the things that you just said here. You're saying that there were far more worthy films. On what basis do you make that judgment?
On the basis of knowing what a good film is. I'll start right there. But also, unlike so many people who talk about this controversy, I've seen them. I saw Belle. I saw Beyond the Lights. Some people who talk about this Selma snub have never seen Selma, let alone the other films by black women. They haven't seen them. They're just using talking points. I've seen them. They're good films. And you know what's especially good about them? It's about both of those films, Belle and Beyond the Lights, are about the black condition. It's about black experience, black psychology, black creativity, black performers. It's not about doctrinaire politics. And this is, whenever there's a movie about black people that doesn't slot them into certain kind of political categories, the mainstream media and the Academy never get it. You make a movie where a black character is a stereotype, and most likely a pathological stereotype or a historical stereotype, then the Academy gets it. Then the mainstream media gets it. But if you make a movie where about blacks as people, those films are always ignored by the mainstream. And that's really a terrible and saddening occasion. You make a movie that's about the Selma March, that's about the Civil Rights Movement, that is purportedly about Martin Luther King, and the mainstream media notices. You make a movie like Beyond the Lights about how a black woman maneuvers sexism in the entertainment industry. You make a movie like Belle where a biracial black woman deals with her personal identity, and nobody pays attention. Even though I say they're good movies, and even though they're both written and directed by black women. So why is it that Selma is getting attention, but those other films aren't? I think the obvious reason is that the mainstream media is able to manipulate thinking about black people whenever they can use politics as a way of slotting black people into certain categories.
Well, we do have to take a look at this. You had a lot of big names associated with Selma, not the least of which are Brad Pitt as a producer and Oprah Winfrey, both acting in it and, of course, backing it. You have quite a lot of money associated with Selma. You also had the strategic advantage of marketing, which you pointed to. The film was timed to come out, to coincide with Martin Luther King Day. The White House received it had a screening. All of this is big stuff, big time marketing. And it was almost a sense of assurance that this movie somehow was to have been branded as a kind of endorsement of Hollywood's racial liberation, if you will, that by, you know, this was supposed to be, I imagine, a kind of, on the scale of a Steven Spielberg kind of film. So it was quite telling that you had all this, I mean, vocal animosity expressed against the Hollywood hierarchy because the film just did not win in categories that they had expected to. Was that the right thing for people to do, or was it better to simply just, you know, note it and move on?
Note it and move on would have been the right thing to do. I mean, you know, there are hundreds, thousands of filmmakers who don't get Oscar nominations, and you just move on. You don't waste time about it. You don't whine about it. You don't gripe about it. You don't call out black activists or civil rights activists to complain about it. That's really rather bad form. You know, if you didn't get an Oscar nomination, you know, the satirical cartoon that came out last year called The Lego Movie, which is I enjoyed and a lot of other people enjoyed it, but it failed to get an Oscar nomination in the animation category. And the guys who made it, they sent out a tweet saying, this is not a tragedy. And to me, that's the right attitude. So you didn't get an Oscar nomination. It's not a tragedy. Stop whining. You know, you've got Oprah Winfrey behind you. You've got Brad Pitt behind you. You've got their influence and their money behind you. Stop whining. There are more important things. And you really, when you whine about it, you really got a nerve to whine about it when lesser and in some cases, better filmmakers like Gina Prince-Bythewood and Ama Asante don't get nominations, and they don't whine. Grow up.
Well, people may say, just the same, that this is more than about art. It is also about money. It's also about professional standing in the community, that they are entitled to, quote, defend their space or what they perceive to be their rightful space in that community. And they are comparing themselves to what they consider to be lesser quality movies that are doing quite well and that are winning prizes. Well, and because winning is also about, being bankable, being successful at the box office, that when something is so obviously, when you're so obviously injured, and again, I'm going with that word snub, because there's a sense that, well, okay, we are reasonably sure of some kind of return on this investment, and that in turn will translate into our rise within, our ascendancy within our profession and so forth. When all of that is on the line and it doesn't happen, people tend to get sour.
They do. And you say it well. And I apologize for getting a little annoyed in my last answer, because I guess I am a little annoyed at rich people whining. But they are rich people. And by the way, they got an Oscar nomination for Best Picture of the Year. They got a nomination for the big prize. How dare you whine? But your point is well taken. Because they're rich, because they're powerful, because they spent a lot of money, because they use the wizardry of marketing and advertising hype, they are annoyed that the plot failed. Well, it failed, and you know why it failed? Here's my suggestion as to why it failed. It failed for the simple fact that Selma, as a movie, isn't good enough. This is no reflection on whether or not the civil rights movement mattered, on whether or not Martin Luther King was a great man. Of course he was. It's simply a reflection on Hollywood egotism and Hollywood money. The movie simply wasn't good enough. Had it been good enough, it would have gotten nominations in every category possible. I would remind your listeners, in fact, that using racism this way, and I think it's a very careless and offensive way, is not new. People have already forgotten last year's complaint. There were complaints that the other Oprah Winfrey movie from last year, the miserable film The Butler, got zero nominations, and there was whining about that. So here we are again, rich people whining again because they feel entitled not just to money, but to prizes and honorifics. And when they don't get it, they are then able to manipulate the media to do more whining for them. But I think really that's all it is.
I want to draw on your history here. And it occurred to me that there's an irony here in terms of the tale of two Oscars. The Oscars, of course, for the industry, and another Oscar Michaud. Could these folks have taken a clue from Oscar Michaud? And could you give us an idea of how you relate the two?
Well, Oscar Michaud was not a part of the Hollywood system. And by not being a part of the Hollywood system, he is, in effect, ostracized by that mainstream institution. And this is a risk. This is a risk that black people take when they work in the media, when they work in the arts. If you are true to yourself and you're any good at all, you stand the chance of being ostracized. And this is what happened to Oscar Michaud. Maybe the people associated with Selma might have followed his valiant example of going your own way and working hard at it, whether or not white people pay attention, if they knew the history of Oscar Michaud.
Could you talk a bit about the history of Oscar Michaud?
Well, Oscar Michaud was a black filmmaker who started making movies during the silent era, during the 1920s. And he was one of those persons who felt that black people were not being well served by the entertainment system. So he wanted to make movies about black people, and he did it. And he made films that played on a kind of film equivalent of the Chitlin Circuit, movies that played in black communities and black movie houses, or maybe even in white movie houses on the nights that they allow black people in. And so Oscar Michaud always worked in the margins, but Oscar Michaud was also an experimenter. He's also an artist. He made serious films like Beyond These Gates and many, many others. But he's always been on the periphery of film history. But he's always been an honorable figure because he worked seriously and he worked steadily. He worked diligently and an honorable figure. There have been several black awards groups from made up by critical organizations and others. And I don't think that any of them have ever named a prize after Oscar Michaud, though they should. But he's a good example to always keep in mind and to always follow. And probably if Oscar Michaud had made a film about fairly recent black political history, it might have been of much more interest and more complexity than something like Selma. Also, more importantly, Oscar Michaud, he's one of the few filmmakers who justifiably made movies for a specific audience. And this is going to take us into a different area, but I don't think Selma was actually made for black people. Being that it was produced by Brad Pitt and Oprah Winfrey, I think it was actually made for white audiences, white viewers. Not that there's anything wrong with that, but I think its real goal was to try to impress white people. And so I guess if you consider that, I guess Oprah and Brad and their friends are really upset that the people they made this movie for didn't respond more gratefully. But, that's the risk you take. And
that brings me to this question. Do you believe that black filmmakers today, how would you categorize the work? Is it uneven? Do you see a sense of hope about things? Or do you see an insistence, the priority being acceptance within this world of Hollywood?
The film, because Ava DuVernay could not get the rights to actually quote King's speeches, she makes up speeches, but I admit she makes them up in his spirit, but she makes them up, and so that's really how the entire film works. It's Ava DuVernay's impression of the civil rights movement. It's her impression of Martin Luther King, and that's legitimate too. I wish people would recognize that before they respond to the film as if it were fact, as if it were the history itself. It's not that. It's Ava DuVernay's version of history, which is allowable, of course. But another interesting aspect to that is that the film says not so much that the civil rights movement of the 1960s mattered. It implies simply that we have arrived, we meaning black people. It also implies that, you know, we have white respect, we have white acceptance. Look, a multi-million dollar film produced by some of the richest people in the world are behind this movie. We have arrived, and ain't it grand? Well, it's grand if the richest people in the world pay you, but if they haven't, I simply want a good movie, a convincing movie. I'm not just satisfied that it's another movie out there, because there are so many.
There are many African-American people in the industry who have come forward, and they're very upset, people like Spike Lee and Lee Daniels and others. What do you think of their complaints?
Not much. And you have to remember that, these are people, Spike Lee and Lee Daniels, who are, in a sense, typical filmmakers. What's a typical filmmaker? A typical filmmaker is a hustler. You don't become a filmmaker because you have talent. You don't become a filmmaker because you have good ideas. You become a filmmaker, a professional, well-paid filmmaker, because you're a hustler. And what is the one identifiable fact about a hustler? A hustler has a huge ego. And so we're back to that idea again that here are egotistical people who are upset that their ego wasn't sufficiently appreciated in their terms. So that's what Spike Lee and Lee Daniels have in common with Oprah Winfrey and Brad Pitt. They're egotists. So when rich egotists complain, sorry to go back to that, we have a right to look at it with a little skepticism. Not everybody's going to get an Oscar. Stop whining about that minor thing. Stop embarrassing black people by saying that a slight at the Academy Awards is equal to a racist offense. It's not. It's merely a slight. It's an unimportant slight, if I can be kind of redundant about it. And they really shouldn't be complaining. When Lee Daniels got many, and I add undeserved nominations for the disgraceful movie Precious, he was there with bells on, grinning like it was a graduation photo op. So for him to come back a few years later and say that and complain that Selma didn't get a nomination, that's really kind of it's not very respectful of him about the Academy itself. He was their pet a few years back, so he shouldn't do it for that reason. Spike complains about everything, as we all know, and you can surely bet that when the Academy gets around to honoring Spike, he'll be there. He'll be there with bells on. So we needn't really pay attention to those kinds of complaints.
Wow. So what do you really think, Armin?
Well, it's just true, and I think everybody knows it if they bother to think about it and stop thinking like gossip columnists.
Now, this movie, again, I mean, so much. It really shocked me that this movie had taken on so many different dimensions of civil rights activism. And, you know, I would wish, for example, Al Sharpton's involvement would have been basically directed to justice in Ferguson. But he has time to talk about the diversity issue of Hollywood. And you mentioned to me that this whole thing is what you called a racial hustle. What do you mean by that?
I think it is. Well, you know, people who use race, the issue of race, the problems of racism, use it as a way to get attention for themselves, use it as a way to get money for themselves, use it as a way to get power. They hustle race. It's a fact. And race hustlers come in many stripes. Race hustlers come in many colors. For all the many times that Al Sharpton has stood behind powerless black people, it's kind of embarrassing to see him make an issue of this non-issue. He really should know better. he really should. I think I think he has better things to do. In fact, except that in this climate, he's become the Hollywood, the mainstream media's go-to guy. So that even when last month, when the hacking of the Sony Pictures account occurred, and embarrassing emails from one of the executives about Barack Obama were released, that executive called Sharpton. Why? Why? Except that he's become the go-to guy, and they're wasting his time as well as ours when they do things like that. But also, you know, they're using Al Sharpton as part of the race hustle that goes on too frequently. But I also want to say, though, Al Sharpton, who was an acolyte of James Brown, I would have loved for him to have made a statement saying, Selma was not the only film by black filmmakers that deserved recognition. There were others, including and perhaps especially Get On Up, which was the biopic about James Brown, who Al Sharpton swears by, salutes, loves, adores, and mentions quite frequently. His life was intertwined with James Brown's. It would have been wonderful if Al Sharpton had made the point that Get On Up, another movie that I think is superior to the film Selma, that got no Oscar nominations. It would have been a beautiful thing if Al Sharpton had pointed that out. But since he didn't, I will. And to go back to a point, one of the problems of movies like Selma is that the slot that they put black people in is as victims or sufferers throughout history. This is true, I know, but it's one of the ways that black people are further manipulated and used by the mainstream media. Selma gets attention. Selma got a Best Picture Oscar nomination because it allows that kind of pigeonholing of black people to occur. I suggest that Get On Up and the remarkable performance by Chadwick Boseman as James Brown was ignored because in a movie like that, you have a figure that cannot be contained by the way white people want to slot black folks. As James Brown was portrayed in that movie and performed by Chadwick Boseman, he is a radical artist who confounded everybody. He was a genius innovator who confounded everybody. And that's the kind of thing that you don't get Oscars for because it's still not accepted. It's still not approved. But it's a great film. It's a wonderful performance. And James Brown, of course, is a great artist.
I want to thank you so much for this chat and for your insights. I hope you can come back and do a special lecture for us, Armand, on film. I happen to believe, I always have, that you are one of the finest film critics in the country and also of a critic of contemporary pop culture. Thank you so much for being with us today.
My pleasure.
Thanks. We come back and talk about a battle in Staten Island right after this. You're listening to PRN.FM, and you're listening to Lead Stories on PRN.FM. I'm Eutrice Lead. Attorney at War, Alton H. Maddox Jr. returns to us today for part two of his discussion on the Eric Garner case, focusing on his intended showdown in state Supreme Court in Staten Island, New York, tomorrow as legal counsel to Ramsey Otta, who had videotaped the fatal police encounter with Eric Garner, including the chokehold that a medical examiner said caused Garner's death. Maddox says he intends to defend Order on a gun possession charge in defiance of an illegal action by the state legislature more than 25 years ago that barred him, not disbarred him, but that barred him from the practice of law. So, Alton, the showdown is tomorrow. Tell us about what you intend to do.
Well, People versus Order, which is a case that involves the videotaping of the chokehold death of Eric Garner, starts from the narrow and moves to the broad. And I say that in the sense that under the Constitution, and particularly the Sixth Amendment, Ramsey Order triggered this matter in September when he stated to the court that he wanted me as his counsel. And by saying that, it put in focus for New York the question of whether an indefinite suspension is legal and can continue after the 22nd of January. And so in that sense, he has already pretty much written his own meal ticket, because you have a situation where even if his case goes up on appeal for any particular matter, the question is going to be the statute of limitations is already run, because it started in August and he wanted counsel in August and he did not get counsel in August, and so we're now going into February, so you only have a few more weeks before it will be time barred in his particular case under any circumstances. But what is important as it relates to me is that I am entitled to either one or two things. One, I'm entitled to a de novo hearing because New York has to explain why under a 5-year suspension an attorney has been barred for 25 years. And this is like a person in prison given a 5-year sentence and still in prison 25 years later. And even if the person escapes prison and is captured later, New York still would have to explain why he's being prosecuted for escape when he should have been out of prison 20 years ago.
Why were you suspended 5 years for 5 years?
I was suspended for 5 years starting on August 1st, 1994. And that would have carried me to July 31st, 1999. However,
what was the charge?
Well, the charge in their language was failure to cooperate with a grievance committee. But in using the Bill of Particulars, the charge was refusing to violate the attorney-client privilege.
You were ordered to turn over all of your notes and all of your tapes, all of your materials relating to Tawana Brawley.
And Al Sharpton. And Al Sharpton, because, I started to represent him, and then he also was involved in the case. And then when Dr. Jones and I, William Augustus Jones and I, went over to the disciplinary committee's headquarters, and upon final reflection, they decided that Dr. Jones could come in with me, even though he wasn't an attorney. The transcript shows that they said this case involved both Tawana Brawley and Al Sharpton, and we intend to get any information that we obtained from you and turn it over to the New York State Attorney General.
That's what, and you refused.
And I refused.
And I remember that following that action, you had insisted on a trial. You had insisted on a public trial.
Right.
And it was not forthcoming.
Right. And so, you know, now we find ourselves here now where the court has to in one way or another, because if they don't, I'm going to file a writ of mandamus, which basically requires judicial officials to do what they're absolutely required to do, and in this case, to grant a de novo hearing. Now, the reason why the de novo hearing is important, because now you have all of these judges, all of these prosecutors like Elliot Spitzer and like the current prosecutor, as well as the attorney general, having to come before a judicial tribunal and under cross-examination have to testify as to all of these crimes that they perpetrated. And so this is another ball game where you have to imagine that if you're not going to give a person automatic reinstatement rights to practice law, then you at least got to do that. And it would seem as though it would be preferable to just say, well, just go and represent order, and we'll forget about the rest of this.
Well, this is going to be, in effect, a combo trial, because, number one, you're testing this illegal barring. I've never heard of a barring of an attorney by a state legislature, but that is exactly what has happened to you. The Bar Association could not take action and did not take action against you because there was no charge against you.
Right.
And they had no reason at all to take any action against you. And so the state attorney general at the time,
Bob Abrams.
Robert Abrams went to the state legislature and asked them to take action. It was one of the first times in the country that a state legislature, mm-hmm. quote, barred, unquote, an attorney from the practice of law. So that is explosive itself. And then comes the fact that you will be presenting yourself in a court of law as the counsel for Ramsey Otta. And now, what is a judge supposed to do? What are you expecting? Is a judge supposed to say, okay, let's rule on whether Maddox could actually be in this court, first of all, or whether he's going to rule on the Otta case?
Well, the reason why I have actually been in communication with the Chief Justice of the New York Court of Appeals, because he actually has the authority to oversee all judicial actions. So where you have a state like New York, which has four appellate divisions going from Brooklyn to Manhattan to Albany to Buffalo, the chief judge is over all of those different divisions. In my case, it is before the appellate division second judicial department, even though it should have been before the appellate division first judicial department, because like C. Vernon Mason, I was also admitted to practice law in the first department. The first department took the position that they would not violate the attorney-client privilege of C. Vernon Mason and demand him to turn over the files. So while Mason eventually had some disciplinary problems, they did not relate to Tawana Brawley. In my particular case, the second department took a whole different view and said that we are going to do what we are going to do. Now, what has developed out of that is another issue, which I call judicial gerrymandering, because if you look at New York and you look at the abuses that occur in New York, you have to ask yourself, why is it that the first department only has two counties in it, period? And that's the Manhattan, which is New York County, and Bronx County. That's only two. In the second department, it has all of these counties in it. And they start from Staten Island, and they work their way up to Westchester County, Dutchess County, Putnam County, all the way around. Now, what is interesting is that all of the abuses that most blacks suffer are out of the Second Department. You know, if you look at the case of Eric Garner, that's a Second Department case. You look at the case of Sean Bell, that's a Second Department case. You look at the case of Tawana Brawley. You look at the case of John White. All these cases are Second Department cases. And my contention is, beyond these other issues, is that we as a people have been gerrymandered into a particular district in which the slave codes are being applied to defendants. And so, you know, we know this for a fact because in the case of John White, who is a homeowner in Suffolk County, and a white lynch mob came out to his house, and he eventually, to stop them from going in and raping his wife and harming his boys, used a firearm to defend himself. And the Appellate Division, Second Department, said that he should have called out 911 first. He should not have pulled out a gun and used it against a white man. Now, this is a slave code, which is being, and that's a matter of record, so it's not like we're trying to figure this out. And that's the same thing that happened with, I can assure you, Eric Garner, which is why they don't want to release the grand jury instructions in Eric Garner, because we have all been lumped, meaning if you're in Brooklyn, if you're in Queens, you're in Long Island, you're upstate New York, we've all been lumped in one appellate division where they applied the slave codes. And so that's the reason why my going out to Staten Island raised a whole lot of bigger issues than just Ramsey Order.
Ramsey Order is facing two felony counts, third-degree right. criminal possession of a weapon and criminal firearm possession. This arrest occurred less than a month after he videotaped the chokehold death of Eric Garner. And he was said to have uttered at the time that he considered it a revenge arrest because he said, that's because you're just mad because I filmed your boy. Referring to Officer Daniel Pantaleo, who was seen in the video applying the chokehold.
Right.
What is going to be your position in court on tomorrow
Order? Look, this is my position. The position, as I said, the case go from the narrow issues to the broad issues. And so we're not about to abandon the broader issues, because the broader issues are some things I just talked about now. And so when I deal with a case, you treat, I don't deal with it like a normal lawyer who just looks for a little narrow thing to come out of a courtroom with. I'm not going into Staten Island on a narrow issue. I'm going on the issue of judicial gerrymandering. I'm going on the issue of representation, taxation without representation. There's a lot of broad issues. So, you know, what I am saying is they will all be addressed. Now, am I going to sit here today and give a bill of particulars everything I plan to do? No. But my point is there's too much at stake just to think that this case is only about Ramsey Order, because you have too many other issues that are detrimental to our people, and nobody's raising those issues. So you don't have one person in this state who is prepared to stand up with Ramsey Order. You don't have one person in the state who is prepared to give you an agenda of all of the things that are really affecting our people. And so when you get ready to start this, you don't start it as a personal injury action. You start it as a class action. You look at what affects the class. And how do we come out of this with a remedy for the class and not just simply for Ramsey Order? I mean, Ramsey Order is going to be taken care of, but there are other issues in which people won't be taken care of, and that's where we need to start, because we don't have any representation in New York at all. I mean, there's not going to be any black selected officials out there tomorrow. You know, there's not going to be any leading blacks out there tomorrow. And so it all rests upon one person to take a sweep as to what the problem is. And that's exactly what I intend to do.
So this case, then, in the narrow sense, as we've been discussing, the narrow sense, it's a case involving an arrest for criminal possession of a firearm.
Mm-hmm.
You're saying that you'll take that is an issue that will be addressed, but
right.
You see this case as now being a pivotal point in raising the larger issues that so far have not come to fruition.
Yeah, and that's exactly my point, and I don't want to abandon any of these issues because they're all very critical. And if I'm going to come out, then I need to come back with most that I could accomplish. And my being there is not just in defense of Ramsey Order, who lives in Staten Island, but it is in defense of John White, who is in Suffolk County. It's in defense of Tawana Brawley, who is up in Dutchess County. I mean, there's a lot at stake. And so, you know, I'm not just going out there as I've never done. I mean, look, I practiced most of my cases with pro bono, but I didn't practice pro bono law just to take a narrow issue.
Let's talk about you for in the specific issue of, you know, you've been a target of the state for quite some time. You've suffered this unusual action of being barred from the courts for more than 25 years, almost 30 years now. So you know that that still is a very much in the consciousness of the state to continue to persecute you. What do you have to gain by engaging, and why do you continue to engage?
Well, the reason why I intend to engage is the same reason that my ancestors continue to engage. I mean, the same reason why Nat Turner, you know, took this route in Virginia, the same reason why Denmark Vesey took the similar route in South Carolina. You know, I mean, the finish line is our liberation. And, you know, and even Dr. King said, and we just celebrated him the other day, and of course, a lot of people don't really believe in Dr. King, but he said, "You know, I may not, be, I may not be there, but I will get that with you." And so, basically, what he's saying was that there's a finish line, and that we all should be working to get to that finish line. That's what really Dr. King's legacy is picking up the ball and continuing to move toward that finish line. And we have to use it from one generation to the next, then we just be a relay team. But there are no innocent bystanders in a class action. So the people that listen to me now should know that if you are a person of African ancestry or a descendant of enslaved Africans, there are no innocent bystanders, and you have to really explain why all hands are not on deck. Why you are in some way decided that you are some privileged character that you can abandon the goals of others who come before you. Because all of these ancestors that we have always told us that we got to get to a finish line. And unfortunately, only a few of us want to take heed, but the obligation to do it still exists.
When you walk into court tomorrow in Staten Island, would there be any representatives from your profession standing by you?
Well, I haven't heard of anybody from my profession saying anything. You know, I haven't received any phone calls. It was interesting to me that I was listening to your former employer on WBAI the other day and on the Howard Jordan program, and attorney Anthony Rico, who I've known for years, was on there. And he was saying that there are so many great lawyers, black lawyers out here. And my response to that is, and I want somebody to call Anthony Rico's office and ask him, would he be in Staten Island tomorrow, not to represent me, but to introduce to me to all of these fine black lawyers in New York State.
Wow. So the battle continues. Could you give us the particulars of when this case is going to be called, what part, and how people can get there?
Well, what I will say is this: there is a telephone number on some of the websites that I have used, www.reinstatealtonmatic.com, and there is some telephone numbers there. But I would prefer, Eutrice, if everybody who has a question would pick up the phone, dial 311, and ask them to pin you into the clerk's office at the Staten Island Supreme Court. I think that's the most effective way that we can make of our voices being heard, because the governor of the state of New York is right as we speak doing a state of the state address. People should call up to the governor's office today and say, well, why were we on that agenda? I mean, you know, why didn't you say anything about Eric Garner? And why didn't you say anything about Ramsey Orton? And why didn't you say anything about all the other victims of racially motivated murders and police-inspired murders? I mean, what happened to that part of the agenda? That's what other people would do. You see, we have to not let other people marginalize us by keeping quiet. You know, we should be making the most joyful noise today, and we should be calling everybody today and each time asking for 311 in order to do that. That's what we should be doing today, all day. There are no innocent bystanders. Other people are going to have to do some things. We need to be making a joyful noise so that the people in Staten Island should know that there are going to be a large contingent of people coming to Staten Island tomorrow, and we want to make sure that we have the largest courtroom in order for everybody to sit. We shouldn't have to go to Staten Island tomorrow, and then when we're told we got to be in a closet, then get upset. See, that's not the way you deal with it. You deal with it in advance by making a noise all over the place. And we have consistently been manipulated and then been betrayed by every conceivable person under the sun, including the current mayor of the city of New York, William de Blasio.
How do people get to the courtroom, and what time is the trial?
Well, the court is 9 o'clock, and what you will do is to take the Staten Island Ferry, which is free, and that's the way, you know, that I only know to do, because I've been in Staten Island and in its courts on many occasions. And when you exit the Staten Island Ferry, the courtroom would be in front of you, and you just simply walk up to the Richmond County Supreme Court. You can't miss it, because there's a big wall there, and you got to run into it.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Alton. We will definitely follow, because this case, a lot of people are watching this case. A lot of people who ought to be there also are watching this case. I'm referring specifically to the lawyers for the Garner family and for
absolutely.
And referring to Al Sharpton as well. It's
and
a pity.
They will be there, of course, you know, but they should be.
Yes. So thank you, and we'll follow up on this case. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you very much, Eutrice. And remember, 311. Dial it early and often.
Thank you. Well, that brings us to the end of our program today. Two rather interesting segments that should get us rethinking things about the battle in Hollywood and the battle that is about to unfold tomorrow in State Supreme Court in Staten Island as Ramsey Orton comes to trial, and we will see whether the court permits the trial to go forward with his defender, Alton Maddox. Thanks for being with me. It's a pleasure always and a great privilege to be in your company. You can contact me at leadstories@gmail.com or on Facebook, Lead Stories with Eutrice Lead. Keep it right here on PRN.FM and tell a friend about this wonderful radio station and your favorite program on it, Lead Stories. See you tomorrow. Bye-bye.